Okay. We're ready now. Special time, huh? You want to do executive?
We got a couple, I know, like, well, we're in conservation. I know we've got a couple of external partners, like Fish and Wildlife Service, we can do a few of these.
Sure. So we'll go to Chairman Bevins, Conservation Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
The first order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes from the August 25th meeting, which have already been distributed. There, as I recall, there was some discussion in the wording on an issue, particular motion, and is that reconciled?
Yes.
Commissioner Duggan, you, was that?
Yeah, that's been correct. Here.
Thank you.
Yes, that's been correct.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's see. Is there a motion for approval of the minutes that's been distributed? Made by Martin.
Second.
Second by Hickson. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Hearing none, the motion passes. I would like to say there are a couple of changes to the order of the agenda that I need to mention. Committee item number 2, Val Verde County Land Project, Devil's River State Natural Area Property Exchange, will be heard after the executive session this afternoon. Also, committee item number 11, land exchange in Blanco County, 300 acres for the Ferdinand Falls State Park Conservation Project, will also be heard after committee item number 8. Committee item number 1, update on TPW progress in implementing the TPWD Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. Mr. Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of land and water action plans or action items from the plan that I want to report on. I've already touched on one of them, which had to do with the extensive outreach and planning efforts that our Wildlife Division team is doing with private landowners. You will recall there was a very specific actionable goal to increase the number of acres under Parks and Wildlife Management plans from 23.5 million to 26 million acres by December of 2011. At this juncture, we have, I think, 6,300 landowners or cooperatives with active plans encompass 25,467,000 acres. So I think with a little luck, Clayton may get there by Christmas. We're well on our way in that on that front. Also, another action item was making sure that we were doing everything we could to locate and study and identify and understand the properties of springs that we haven't had a chance to study and really understand. Obviously, we certainly recognize the criticality and value of our springs in terms of sustaining base flows in our creeks and rivers. We've got a multidisciplinary cross-division team that has been formed from inland fisheries, wildlife, coastal fisheries, and state parks that is working on that, going out and collecting various hydrologic characteristics, physical and chemical and biological properties from those springs. And then maintaining that in our natural diversity database. So very important biological data that the team is collecting at this time. The Wildlife Division has been in the process of transitioning their prescribed fire program to meet the National Wildfire Coordinating Group standards, or the NWCG standards. That's the very best in class, highest standard, and the team has been making a lot of progress on that front. Recently hired Glenn Gilman, who's a very accomplished and experienced prescribed fire specialist, to lead that team, and I think that's going to help a lot as we work to expand our prescribed fire acres around the state. So that's really encouraging. I mentioned the Desert Bighorn Sheep restoration, and again, I mean, this is a big deal with respect to reintroducing desert bighorns into the Bocasillos Mountains out at Big Bend Ranch State Park. And so our wildlife biologists and state park team have been working hand in hand to try to get that accomplished. We're hoping to have that done maybe by the end of this calendar year. So I think that would be a very, very exciting development as we work to stock those mountains. I think it's important for all of you to know that as part of that effort, we've continued our very aggressive control efforts of all-dead sheep. And, you know, we have a lot of concern about the possible competition, but also the interspecific transmission possibility of some diseases that can be transmitted from audads to desert bighorn. And so we have and will continue to have an active role of controlling audad sheep in that area, which we're going to be putting bighorn sheep in. So just wanted to make sure that this commission was apprised of that. It is something that is of interest to some of our constituents, but obviously an important biological need that I know this commission has talked a lot about. We also have talked in the last year about the significance of the fact that zebra mussels were found at Lake Texoma, obviously not a welcome interloper in our state, to say the least. Our fisheries biologist also discovered zebra mussels in Sister Grove Creek, which is a distributary from Lake Texoma that ultimately leads into Lake Lavon, which is, of course, the headwaters of the Trinity River and one of the sources of drinking water for the city of Dallas. And so Gary Saul and his team, Dave Terry, Brian Van Zee, and a bunch of others worked very, very diligently to secure the appropriate approvals from EPA and TCEQ and the Department of Agriculture to do an experimental treatment along 32 miles of Sister Grove Creek to try to kill zebra mussels that had been found there. We absolutely want to keep them out of the Trinity River. That is a major goal of ours. They worked very cooperatively with the North Texas Water Municipal District to stop interbasin transfer of water so that it could stop the possibility of zebra mussels being transmitted through those interbasin transfers. Really an extraordinary effort, and Gary, want to compliment you and Dave and Brian and your team on that because they had to work through a very complicated permitting process to get approvals to do that, and absolutely the right thing to do in terms of protecting our fisheries and our water bodies from an invasive species, an exotic species that we've seen had hugely detrimental impacts in other water bodies and other states. So kudos to that team.
So have we done that?
We have.
We have. And
sorry, Gary.
Excuse me, I'm used to telling from sitting.
I understand.
Excuse me, I'm Gary Saul, Inland Fisheries Director. We have done multiple treatments on the stream. We felt as though we did a very, very successful treatment the first time. We found a few stragglers in the upper reaches of the stream. We came back within our permit. We still had the opportunity to come back in and retreat. We have done that. And excuse me, today we have our folks, we have three teams up there today looking to see whether or not there are any other canaries in the stream, basically. But we believe we've done a very, very good job now to get them out of there. So.
How positive can we be that we've achieved success? I mean,
it's tough.
It's probably impossible to say that we have 100% success. We've gone out and we turn rocks, we do anything and everything to look to see where they've been. We had monitors, in-stream monitors, during the period of treatment to go ahead and look at what the salt concentrations were, and basically what we used was a potassium chloride that would be harmful to would kill the zebra mussel but not harm the other aquatic life. And by raising that salt level, if we could hold it up for about 48 hours, that would typically go ahead, that would kill the zebra mussels. The graphs that we have, all the data that we've collected, shows that we did an excellent job of bringing it up to that threshold level and holding it. Little variability in the very upper reaches of the stream, and that's where we found those few remnant individuals, and that's where we absolutely need to go back and retreat, because they become a new founding population for everything downstream. So we're targeting very, very aggressively now upstream.
This protocol doesn't interfere with any other plant or animal?
No, sir.
Right.
Well, to your comment on how successful this will be, I was at a boat mechanic's place near Granbury last week, and he had said he had three boats brought to him that were Granbury boat owners, had been up at Texoma, and all three of them, the motors were, had failed due to zebra mussels. And so I mean, that's the concern I have, is moving forward.
Oh, yeah.
Don't recognize how critical it is to look at their boats and you
know, clean them. And,
yeah, the shaft of the motor was just full of zebra mussels.
And remember, these things are about the size of your fingernail. So, and there are ample places on the hull and motors and boats where they can be, in which we don't catch them. I mean, our, you know, I want y'all to know that, you know, complacency has not been an option for us. And, you know, our inland fisheries and law enforcement teams have really, really been pushing hard in communication on the outreach and education and enforcement. It's amazing how many people know what a zebra mussel is these days as a function of that of that effort. But the you know, the Hello Goodbye Invasive Species campaign that y'all helped launch with the governor has been part of that. The Stop Aquatic Hitchhikers, which is a successful program by the Fish and Wildlife Service, which we're a part of, another important effort there to educate the boating community about the criticality of not transmitting these exotic species from one lake to another. So.
And Brian Van Zee of our staff just went down to the National Marina Association meeting that was held down at South Padre Island, I believe, a week or two ago, and had an excellent presentation, had a very, very good interaction with everybody that was down there. There's a tremendous level of interest. It's extremely costly to the owner. And the marinas have a great opportunity. They are very important to us in terms of spotting a vessel that's being moved and to be launched at their place or looking at one that's coming out. And they've been very helpful in terms of identifying those boats to us.
Are we going to the marinas, just for example, at Granville and alerting those where the boat ramps are that you ought to be proactive?
Yes, absolutely. We have signs up all over Lake Texoma. We've put signs up on all boat ramps to go ahead and try and educate the public. And then our staff have been going to various boat to marinas and other places to visit with
inbound.
Yes. In Texas. Yes, to try and let people know as it's coming, you know, as it's coming in.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Okay. Let's see, as I stated earlier, we will hear a presentation on committee item number 2 after the executive session this afternoon. We now move to committee item number 3, the potential black-footed ferret reintroduction. Sean Connett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Sean Kyle. I'm the wildlife diversity biologist for the Panhandle District. Texas Parks and Wildlife is currently examining the feasibility for a small experimental reintroduction of the black-footed ferret. This project would be a collaborative effort with several other agencies and would support multiple objectives under Texas Parks and Wildlife's Land and Water Resources Conservation Plan. First, I'd like to introduce some of the partners that are involved in this effort with us. And they're here to help answer the Commission's questions. First of all, Mike Bodenchuk is in the audience out here. Mike is the Director of Texas Wildlife Services. Next to him is Gary Moad. He's the State Administrator for Ecological Services and Fish and Wildlife Service. And Pete Gober is also here. He's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Black-Footed Ferret Recovery Coordinator. And as I said, they're here to help answer any questions that the Commission may have on this. First off, a little bit of history on this species. The black-footed ferret is really considered to be a keystone species for the Great Plains ecosystems. And black-footed ferrets are closely tied to prairie dogs. They live in prairie dog towns. They kill and eat prairie dogs. Their historic range coincided with three species of prairie dogs on the Great Plains, ranging from the Canadian Plains all the way down into Mexico, and once included nearly half the state of Texas. Now, habitat loss from agricultural conversion, poisoning of prairie dogs, plague, distemper, all contributed to a severe decline in these populations and the range of the species until it was actually thought to be extinct in 1974. In the early 1980s, a small population of about 18 individuals was rediscovered in the Meteetse Valley of Wyoming. That really kicked off a big effort of captive breeding and reintroduction efforts that have since brought this species back really from the verge of extinction. Black-footed ferrets have been reintroduced in 19 locations across 8 states, Canada, and Mexico on both public and private land sites. And current estimates suggest that the populations are now at about 1/3 of the goal for delisting of the species. It's important to note here that this is actually an endangered species that will be delisted. To date, the reintroduction efforts, as you note from this map, have been heavily focused on the northern plains. Texas Parks and Wildlife and partner agencies are examining potential public and private sites for a reintroduction in the Texas Panhandle and Southern High Plains. So, in terms of what we would need to do this, we need approximately 1,500 to 2,000 acres at a minimum of active prairie dog towns with a willing public or private landowner or combination of landowners. A reintroduction could be initiated on a smaller acreage of prairie dog towns with the assurance that towns would be allowed to grow to a point that would support a population of ferrets. Second, we would need a state scientific research permit and a permit under Section 10A-1A of the Endangered Species Act. Third, we would need to conduct some extensive public outreach to identify and address any potential or perceived impacts from this reintroduction. Now, when we start talking about endangered species, it's important to discuss some of the legal issues associated with this. And first off, it's important for us to state that the protection of private landowners and their rights with respect to endangered species compliance is really imperative to this effort. Second, the permitting process for this under Section 10A-1A of the Endangered Species Act pertains to, and this is a quote, establishment and maintenance of experimental populations for the propagation of or survival of a species. Now, this portion of this act is extremely flexible in how it can be applied, and it actually allows us to craft a very strong package of regulatory assurances for landowners that help protect those landowners, their operations, ranching and farming operations, and limit any potential impact that this project might have. For example, I took some of these from a recent reintroduction that happened up in Logan County, Kansas, that was both on private and Nature Conservancy land. First of all, private landowners surrounding the reintroduction site can continue normal ranching and farming practices, including the use of legal toxicants. Note that this considers prairie dog control with legal toxicants to be part of normal ranching and farming practices. Second, private landowners outside of the boundaries of this release site will not be held responsible for any natural or accidental ferret mortality or habitat destruction. That means there is no take of habitat or individuals outside of these boundaries, and functionally, except in the case of intentional killing of individual animals. So functionally what this means is that you actually have an endangered species within a set of confined predefined boundaries. Outside of that, we don't have an endangered species. Next, this project includes boundary control for prairie dogs around the reintroduction site, and this boundary control would be carried out by Texas Wildlife Services and will include poisoning of dogs around the boundaries and on private land outside the immediate boundaries where that is required. Next, the project, it's important to note that this project is experimental and will remain experimental, and that means that the permitting process for this project can be reviewed or renewed indefinitely under Section 10A1A of the Endangered Species Act. There is no requirement to change that status, and that means that until the species is delisted, we always have an escape clause. So in the event that the land changes hands, or a landowner decides he does not want to continue with this effort, or if anything else does not work out, we can catch these ferrets and discontinue the project. So here's a brief update or list of what we've been doing on this effort. First, the Texas Black-footed Ferret Working Group has been formed as an interagency effort to examine the feasibility of a black-footed ferret reintroduction in Texas. This working group includes Texas Parks and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Forest Service, Texas Wildlife Services, Bureau of Land Management, and research partners from Texas Tech University and West Texas A&M. Texas Parks and Wildlife has developed an outreach plan to inform stakeholders on this issue and obtain feedback and address any concerns they may have. Outreach plan, the working group's currently looking at it, and we are actually planning an initial outreach meeting to be held in Amarillo in early December. Texas Parks and Wildlife is also collaborating with U.S. Forest Service and Texas Wildlife Services to assess part of the Rita Blanca National Grassland as a potential reintroduction site, and this includes mapping of prairie dog colonies and dusting to control plague. If there's interest, we will consider other public and private sites for this, but at this point we're really in the stage that we're looking for a place to carry out this project. And that concludes my presentation. I'll gladly answer any of your questions or refer those to my agency partners.
Sean, do we have a representative from the BLM here?
We do not.
I would just like to, are you aware of their efforts along this line?
I'm aware that they have interest in this project. Currently, the one piece of property that the BLM owns in Texas is the Crossbar Ranch. They have some interest in that. They've done a white paper on it. Currently, they're in the process of looking at habitat suitability models. As you're probably well aware, there's no prairie dogs on the Crossbar Ranch.
And by design.
There's a significant amount of work that would actually have to be done to get to that point. So they have interest. It's way out in the future if they were to get to that point.
I would like to make a recommendation that we have a concerted effort to try to contact them, because they are getting way ahead of themselves in this process. And I mean, I really appreciate your presentation mm-hmm. today, and I really appreciate the fact that our department is handling this in a manner that is, you know, in a way that the landowner can get an idea of what's involved prior to the program beginning. Whereas the BLM and their initial meeting in the Panhandle, they treated the Crossbar as a laboratory that they were ready to begin the process in, and they were it was not ever made clear until the actual meeting that in order to release the ferrets, you had to first introduce prairie dogs into the habitat, which the surrounding landowners had been trying to eradicate for generations. And it's just a very unfortunate
surface. Chairman, I'm Ross Millenchuk, Deputy Executive Director for Natural Resources. I can assure you we've had those conversations, with the BLM leadership and kind of alerted them that as a partnership they were getting a little bit ahead of the rest of the partners, and I think they recognize that and have throttled back a bit with the full understanding that it may be a potential site, but we're talking a number of years down the line, and
I want to say how much I appreciate the efforts and the processes that we've followed in making this presentation today, and I think we're doing it in the correct manner, but we want to make sure everybody's talking to everybody else.
Yeah, that's a good point, and something we're, as a team, are sort of underscoring that we're all in this together, and we need to be sort of approaching it in a agreed-upon fashion, and I think they understand that now. The rest of the partners are very much on board in that. So,
where is Rita Blanca National Grass
Harbor? Dahlem County, in the extreme.
Oh, Dahlem. Yeah, okay. Right. And where is Crossbar Ranch?
It's Potter County, just south of the Canadian River, between Amarillo and the Canadian River.
So,
right across the river.
Yeah.
Chairman Bivens, I'd like to add that there's no way that this project can really be, it cannot take place without a partnership of various agencies. If it were to take place on the Crossbar at some point in the future, other agencies would have to be involved in that in terms of boundary control, which I think we can say from experience from other projects, and Pete can speak to this, that boundary control does work. So any of those, if their habitat issues are met, if they wanted to move forward with this, we would have to speak with all the adjoining landowners, sure. Go through the same process with that location.
And then in light of that, is there an equilibrium of the two populations? I mean, do you have, obviously the two species still existed before, the ferret population diminished, so, but once they're introduced, does it achieve an equilibrium where, do the ferrets eradicate the prairie dogs? And then what do we do with the ferrets?
If I could, I'd like to ask Pete Gober to respond to that, who's had experience on these other 19 sites. As we say, we're in the infant stages of this, but I think Mr. Gober could answer that.
Okay. I'm Pete Gober with the Fish and Wildlife Service. We've had a fair amount of experience with this over the past 20 years and 20 sites and lots of partners. And so one thing that Sean didn't elaborate on is ferrets are not exactly diamonds anymore. They may still be gold. We'd like to get them recovered, but we have produced over 7,000 of them in captivity and released close to 3,000 of them across the country. So we can afford to be fairly flexible with this species in terms of take, et cetera. With regard to the issue of a balance, you're going to have dispersing males as soon as you fill that habitat like you would with any other species, and they'll likely go off into non-habitat and be lost. But if there aren't prairie dogs out there, they won't stick. And typically, to get them to stick, you have to have concentrations of prairie dogs along the line of what Sean mentioned. They won't make it in these small, isolated colonies because to be above ground is to be dead if you're a ferret, coyote, or owl, or whatever will pick you off. It's a nocturnal, for the most part, and fossorial animal, so it's going to be below ground most of the time or dead.
Well, where you have areas with an existing prairie dog population and you want to try to control those numbers, I see using, if it's possible to use the ferrets to maintain that objective, I think that's great.
You can dampen prairie dog populations, but of course they wouldn't be a successful predator if they ate themselves completely out of the house.
And right. And can you maintain an existing cattle operation within the area here, foresee that?
I think it's absolutely essential that you maintain grazing, particularly in the mid-grass country, but even in the short-grass country, grazing and these go together with these animals. So you'd want voluntary participation, you'd want continued livestock grazing. In fact, the harder you hit the country, the more likely you are to have prairie dogs, as you know, around windmills or whatever.
Okay, all right. It's an interesting concept.
This is, I guess, my comment for this, since I have a chance to make it, is this is pretty low-hanging fruit for a recovery of endangered species. Every place we put ferrets out, we've had reproduction the first year. if we give you folks the amount of flexibility you need to pull the plug on it, if it gets to be problematic for some reason or another, this is a success story. There's so many species we work with where the biological challenges are overwhelming, social issues are unbelievable. But if you've got wildlife services keeping prairie dogs hemmed in, which Mike has agreed to do, and we can find a way to give you the regulatory flexibility to where you don't feel like you're shooting yourself in the foot when you're trying to do the right thing, this could be a pretty quick success.
I just really want to recommend that we try to find areas with existing populations rather than introduction of prairie dogs, if at all possible.
Right.
I think that might be a headline in Amarillo newspaper.
You're not going to get too far with that.
Yeah. That might be a possum. Well, how'd you put it? Social issues?
Yeah. Kind of like harvest oriented.
Yeah, like harvest oriented.
Thank you.
Yeah,
yes, sir. It does the, is the area around Tahoka suitable?
I'm not aware of any large prairie dog populations out in that area.
I
know there are. Now, we would definitely be interested in talking to you about that, or talking to the landowners about it. We're definitely open to any landowner who would be interested in this.
Let's play ball.
Okay. You know, the thing is the bad thing about ferrets is the same as the good thing about ferrets. They went out because of that dependence on prairie dogs and secondary poisons and nasty poisons in years that were used past. But it's easy to put A and B back. You don't have an equation with 10 variables. You just got A plus B equals success. You've got prairie dogs and you put ferrets out there and there's a fair concentration of prairie dogs, they'll do okay.
Good.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Committee item number four, briefing on competitive renewable energy zones or CREZ transmission line. Kathy, Kathy Boyd.
Hello, Commissioners. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Kathy Boydston. I'm with the Wildlife Habitat Assessment Program in the Wildlife Division. I'm here today to brief you on the PUC establishment of competitive renewable energy zones and Parks and Wildlife role in the subsequent transmission line development. The PUC established these competitive renewable energy zones under direction of the legislature, and Parks and Wildlife's role is established under our code 12.0011, which allows us to provide recommendations to entities that permit and develop projects, and these recommendations will protect fish and wildlife resources. That review of those projects includes electrical transmission lines and renewable energy projects. In 2005, the Texas Senate established Senate Bill 20, which told the PUC, recommended a public utility commission, or the PUC, to look at establishing competitive renewable energy zones, which are productive wind zones in the Panhandle and other parts of the state where there's current wind development and also where wind developers have expressed interest in new development. In 2008, the Public Utility Commission looked at commissioned a study to look at what the transmission needs would be to get the energy from those wind zones to the metropolitan areas where it's needed. They looked at four different scenarios, and of those four, they picked scenario two, which will establish 2,300 miles of new 345 kV transmission line across the state. We'll put 18,000 megawatts of new energy into the electrical grid and could potentially impact 56,000 acres of fish and wildlife habitat. After we realized the magnitude of Senate Bill 20, Parks and Wildlife went to the PUC using our role under 12.0011 and offered our assistance to them in developing these lines with the least amount of environmental impact. They amended their process to include our review role, and we have been working very closely with their staff on reviewing and commenting on these lines since that time. Their process includes a Certificate of Convenience Necessity, or a CCN, which is the permit that's required to build an electrical transmission line. And there's an environmental assessment that's also developed to look at the potential impacts of all those lines. Their process requires that the utility coordinate with us and provide us an early coordination project, sometimes maybe a year in advance, and provide us preliminary route information that we evaluate at a very high level, looking at what federal or state managed lands could be impacted, as well as other fish and wildlife resources. We provide that information to them, and hopefully they use that information to develop the alternatives and the environmental assessment. Now, the environmental assessment also has to include other information regarding design and cost of all the different alternatives, looks at historic features, number of habitable structures, and community values that could be affected by each of the different alternatives. Once that's completed, they file that CCN and then environmental assessment with the Public Utility Commission, and that starts the clock on 180 review time that the Public Utility Commission has to review and provide a final recommendation on each of these projects. The Parks and Wildlife also receives that same application, the CCN and the environmental assessment, and that starts a clock on a 60-day review time that we have to provide comments to the Public Utility Commission. Each of these projects has a staggered filing date. We've been receiving these since January of 2009, so we may receive one project a month, or we might receive six projects in a week. And at any point in time, staff may be looking at several different CREZ projects that are at different stages of our internal review process. Scenario 2 called for 60-plus transmission line projects across the state to be looked at and completed, review completed by between 2009 and 2011, with full build-out of all of these complete by 2013. Now, 30 of those 60 projects were CREZ projects, which are our highest priority projects for during this process. We've completed review on about 45 of those, and we still have approximately 12 or so that are either under review or have not been filed with us yet. My next slide is going to concentrate on looking at one of those specific projects, and we'll be looking at the Riley to West Crum line. Now, each of these lines, each of these projects, has hundreds of different segments that can result in thousands of different alternatives. The utility and their consultants develop these alternatives and bring those forward to Parks and Wildlife with a preferred route. There may be between 30 and 300 different alternatives that we have to evaluate on each one of these projects. We look at scientific in-house information and use the information that's provided in the environmental assessment as well to look at effects on state or federal managed lands, federal and state listed species, ecologically significant stream segments, rare species, and aquatic resources. We then analyze each one of these routes and provide a recommendation to the PUC on which route has the least amount of environmental impact. Now I'm going to highlight just a few of the projects that we've reviewed and commented on. First one is the Great Otezla line that's in the northeastern part of the panhandle. The preferred route on this project would have bisected and fragmented the estimated occupied range of the lesser prairie chicken, which is a candidate species for listing under the Endangered Species Act. Now, there's not much information on what kind of impact these projects have on lesser prairie chickens, but there is some research that indicates they have an aversion to tall vertical structures, and that the presence of these structures could cause the hens to abandon any kind of habitat where they would actually go to brood and rear their young. Our recommendation would have reduced the fragmentation of the estimated occupied range for that bird. On the Silverton to Tesla line, that's in a little bit southern part of the panhandle, and you'll hear more detailed information on this project in a later briefing item. On this project, the preferred alternative could have had will have a direct impact on Capar Canyon State Park and on the trailway. The preferred route crossed the trailway near the park, which presented a big visual impact to the park itself and also a direct impact to the trailway, which constitutes a problem or an issue of taking of state parkland under Chapter 26. There we go. Our preferred route would have completely avoided impacts to the state park and also to the trailway.
Now, can I start? When you say you give this recommendation, is this back to
the PUC?
PUC, okay.
Yes, sir.
Do they have to abide by your recommendation?
Oh, no.
No.
And that's, I don't want to interrupt your presentation, but that is something that I think we need to somehow discuss in that.
Perch.
It's in a way of the fallacy of the whole process, because I mean we make recommendations for the areas that we oversee, and in so many cases they have no reference whatsoever in the decision making process. It's frustrating.
Yeah,
it's only advisory role.
Right. Very frustrating. Kathy and her team, I mean, just to put this in perspective, you know, she got six biologists that work in the wildlife habitat assessment team. They review between 1,200 to 1,500 development projects a year and provide feedback on what the impacts are likely to be to fish and wildlife resources from those development projects, something that we're required to do by statute. Fully three of her FTEs are completely consumed with working on CREZ projects and have been really for the last year and a half or so, and that was likely to only continue in the future. So, you know, while I think this has been an effective way for us in some ways to at least communicate our concerns to PUC and the utility companies, if then there are interveners and it goes to the State Office of Administrative Hearing for negotiating a settlement route that will come back to the PUC to consider, if we are not a formal intervener, then our issues are not represented in that negotiated process. And so at the State Office of Administrative Hearing, when they negotiate a settlement, typically then have a recommended order out of the judge, which then goes to the PUC for approval. So we have chosen on two occasions now to serve as a formal intervener, one on the Hill Country line that has generated so much contention here in Central Texas, and then on another line up in the Panhandle that's likely to have impacts on lesser prairie chickens. And that was really born out of the frustrations we had on a decision-making process up there on another line that had impacts, we believe, to prairie chickens. So we're sorting through that and trying to do what we can where appropriate given limited resources.
Sorry.
Well, are we, I understand we have limited resources to intervene, but can we call on the AG's office to help us there where we need to be perhaps more aggressive in being an intervener in order to get PUC attention?
That's a good question. The AG's office probably is facing the same resource issues, frankly, that we are. There are agencies that do not have in-house counsel, for example, the Historical Commission, and they rely on the Attorney General's office to basically provide their general counsel services. That is a possibility. I've not really explored that. They may want to charge us for that service. I just don't know. I mean, we've just not really explored that.
I'd like to suggest we do that.
Okay.
If they're already becoming involved for another agency, then you don't have the duplication.
Although it does become tricky. I mean, I will just, and I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this. In the one that we did intervene on, and Todd George, the attorney who handled that, is here, I think we were probably incredibly effective, and probably even more so than the folks that were being represented by the Attorney General's office, but that goes more to our mission. The other issue is going to be just the Attorney General's office. There's a special statute that allows them to basically to deal with conflicts of interest. You know how normally in a law firm, if somebody's representing one party, or if you previously represented somebody on another side of the lawsuit, you can't also represent, you can't represent both sides of the same lawsuit. I know.
In four words, you can.
It's not a problem at the Attorney General's office either. There's a special statute that allows them, and they deal with that carefully. I mean, I don't want to suggest that they don't. They deal with that very carefully. They set up walls and programs, but the division that would normally represent us in these things also represents the Public Utility Commission. So there's just a lot of details that we would need to work out in order to do that. Also, just as a practical matter, for most of these, we're kind of past the time for intervention. Intervention deadlines come pretty quickly. This may sound crude, but this is like litigation on meth, because the litigation deadlines are unbelievable here. We've got like 10 days to respond to discovery, 2 days to respond to motions, because they want basically it's like having a lawsuit from beginning to end, including appeals, in 180 days.
Well, that's why it's a good thing to consider tapping that resource, and we can always intervene and then withdraw the intervention.
And we've
and we've approached that doing this so far. I'm not really sure how many more opportunities there are. Do you know?
There's a, like we say, there's about 12 that are in process. A lot of those we have already passed the opportunity to intervene on. And normally we have been intervening on those where we think there's a significant environmental issue that we need to be dealing with.
But that's definitely something I can talk to the Attorney General's office in terms of just help on. If we do think we need to intervene in additional cases, whether they can provide some additional resources.
One other question that Chairman Holt made me think about is in the Sunset Bill, wasn't there a provision that required another agency that didn't accept a recommendation that came from us to give us a reason for that? Is that applicable in this circumstance?
It absolutely is, and in fact, I will say the PUC is taking that extremely seriously. What the provision says is that they have to respond to our comments, and they have to respond, I think it's within like 90 days after the action. And one of the things that they're doing in a lot of their orders is that they're responding to our comments. You know, as with any comments, you may or may not agree with their response, but they're doing that. It doesn't require that they accept our comments, just that they respond to them.
They've been responding to those in their final order, which is the final decision on the product, on the project. And so they basically go through our letter comment by comment and break down whether they're going to accept that and ask the utility to do it or they're not. So they've been very responsive to the NCIS.
Commissioner, by the Sunset legislation, agencies have 90 days from the time at which they take action on a matter in which we commented to provide a response back to us.
I just want to see if they were doing it and if it was a substantive response or just a lip service.
I don't think so. I mean, I think they've given us pretty substantive responses. Again, you know, we may not always see eye to eye, but from the very beginning, PUC staff has taken this provision of Sunset very seriously. Probably, I mean, I will say maybe even more seriously than some other agencies.
And they've started taking some of the our standard recommendations and going ahead and incorporating those, such as, you know, line marking the transmission lines to prevent bird mortality. You know, things like that. Some of our standard recommendations they go ahead and take almost automatically.
Is one of our standard recommendations to recommend that they place the line near existing lines and existing roadways?
Yes, sir, pretty much for the most part. You know, that is what we recommend, with the exceptions of a few species and different habitat types. The lesser prairie chicken would be one of those where that would be the exception to the rule. But yes, we usually require or ask that they locate them next to existing right-of-ways, whether they're highway right-of-ways or transmission line right-of-ways or road right-of-ways, because that usually is where the most disturbance has already occurred and the habitat's already impacted and fragmented.
I've got one question. Make sure I'm clear on the graded health plan.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the alternative routes, preferred routes, and I have recommended that. Did you say they approved the
That's still under discussion. You're going to hear about that. Yes, you're going to hear about that later on in a briefing item with Ted Hollingsworth on they requested an easement to go across the trailway.
I think. Did you say Gray to Tesla?
Are you talking about Silverton to Tesla? Oh, I'm sorry.
Gray to Tesla.
Yes, Gray to Tesla. That's already been made. That decision's already been made.
Okay. In our recommended line was not accepted.
They took the preferred route.
Well, actually, they took a different route. They called it Modified Route 314, which is, I'll go back to this. Sorry, it's several clicks. It's that top line. See where that blue line comes into the red line? Mm-hmm. That very topmost green line, that's the Modified Route 314, and that's what they ended up choosing.
Right through the lesser prairie chicken.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, sir.
Just probably important for this commission to know that when we heard or got word of the preferred final order that was issued by the judge from the State Office of Administrative Hearing that went back to the PUC commission, we did send in a letter to the PUC registering our concerns about that decision. Again, just so you know, that letter created some contention there, and Kathy and our attorney Todd George were there to represent the agency at the hearing, think it was ultimately the position of the PUC that that letter could not be considered evidentiary, and so while there was some discussion of it, it ultimately was not considered when they made their final decision. So that created some issues between the agencies. I think some of the lemonade that came out of that is that the PUC staff then came back with really a recommendation from their commission. If there was an issue like the Lesser Prairie Chicken that we felt very strongly about from a resource perspective, that it was very important for us to consider intervening so that we could then be part of those formal settlements.
Yes.
And so that in turn has led to us to, for example, take that position on another line coming up in the panhandle. So, but I wanted y'all to be aware of that because it
but there's no retroactive ability once the judge has made the decision on the route.
So once a judge has made a recommendation on that and submitted a recommended final order, my understanding of that process and that recommendation, which includes a settlement agreement of all the interveners and the agency, then goes to the PUC commission, and then the commission has the ultimate approval.
Correct.
Is that?
Your question was about appeal, wasn't it?
How the administrative process works is that the hearing officer is really just, or the administrative law judge is just really kind of a fact finder. They will make findings of law and conclusions of fact, and they'll draft a proposed decision. And then that, sometimes it's agreed to, and sometimes it's the result of a contested case hearing, which is like a trial. That goes to the actual Public Utility Commission, the three-member commission. All parties get the opportunity to comment on that and respond to other folks' comments on that proposed order, and then the commission ultimately makes a decision. The thing with the Greta Tesla was that was a settlement agreement, and I think most people who have been involved in litigation know that most of the time a judge, an ALJ, is going to accept a settlement agreement. They're really not going to look too much behind it, and that's pretty much what happened. So by the time it got to the commission, there really wasn't any party that was going to contest it or raise issues about it. So it went to the commission. They pretty much entered an order based on that.
But it's also sometimes very arbitrary. We had one of these in Johnson County where everybody agreed to it, staff agreed to it, and the PUC just rejected it and sent it a different way.
They have the.
And you can, to answer Mark's question, you can then take it to court.
You can go to the courts.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's what's going to happen.
Court Travis County on it.
And we may very well see some appeals out of these.
I don't understand why you would reject a recommendation from this agency and say we're not going to consider it. Can you imagine us getting a letter?
Well, I think
and say we're not going to consider it.
Oh, because wait, I don't know all the background.
I think it's like our involvement in lots of things at other agencies. You know, we have a very specific focus. Our recommendation concerns wildlife. When they make decisions on these lines, they have a number of things that they're required to consider. Habitable structures, economic impacts, and actually I can't list all of those, but we're a piece of that. We're not the whole thing. And, you know, if that's, you know, when we've talked about things that if we want a higher profile, I mean, there may be some other things that we can talk about looking into.
I'm just suggesting it should have been considered whether they agree with it or disagree. Different story, but to just say we're not going to consider it and throw it in the waste can seems arbitrary to me.
And staff has been very helpful to us. After that hearing when the commission basically questioned the admissibility or the evidentiary value of our letter, people from the company Cross Texas actually approached us about things that they might be able to do to help. So, I mean, we're not being completely ignored, I guess.
Yeah, well, the whole thing is, as you said, moving quickly, and it's also a learning process for everybody.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There'll be a lot more of it.
That's true, and there are going to be other lines coming through from Southwest Power Pool that are also within this CREZ process, and then there are going to be other transmission lines that are coming associated with other projects. We're now looking at some transmission lines that are going to be associated with a nuclear power plant expansion that will be coming that could potentially impact a couple of our state parks. So we're by far not through with this.
You're going to be busy. Or stay busy.
Job security.
Job security.
Yes, sir.
But a lot of this is going to end up in the courts. I mean, it's, there's no doubt about this whole thing coming through the Hill Country. I guess probably these others, too. And it, all the landowners already said, we're going to sue, and, you know, counties have said they're going to sue. And so, I mean, it's going to be a, this is going to go on for a while. Yeah.
On the new, the Killeen line, that's in the northeastern part of the Edwards Plateau, on the preferred route on this project, it was going to impact the Lampasas River Valley and also impact potential habitat for two federally listed species, the golden cheek warbler and the black cap vireo. It was also going to follow the Lampasas River for several miles. We recommended the route that follows an existing transmission line between the Perry Haynes Ranch and Fort Hood that reduced the overall impacts of the project greatly.
Did we intervene here?
No. No.
But they made a decision?
Yes, they did. And they picked our route, the route that we recommended. And then some other issues, additional issues that we weren't aware of came to light that had to do with a new airport being constructed, a landing strip being constructed on Fort Hood that had a 5,000 foot, I believe, or 8,000 foot.
Reading about
8,000 foot. No impact zone that would actually bring us down, bring the line down onto onto Perry Haynes. See where that makes that little, the second yellow part of Perry Haynes?
Mm-hmm.
The impact zone would become, come down into that part of Perry Haynes right now. And so we're still in negotiation under that, as far as I know. They're, Fort Hood and other people are looking at different ways to, with working with Encore, which is the utility on that issue, on that project, to try and see if we can get them to do something like bury the transmission line for about, you know, about 1,000 feet between the along that easement, which would be the best solution for both parties. But that's very expensive problem.
Very expensive.
And there's maintenance issues.
And maintenance.
So this is the big one, McCamey D, the Kendall Gillespie. This is the one we have intervened on in the heart of the Hill Country. Unfortunately, all of the routes on this line are going to have an irretrievable and irreversible impact on habitat across the Hill Country. One of the routes proposed comes within 500 feet of Old Tunnel Wildlife Management Area, which is owned and managed by Parks and Wildlife and is home to over 3 million Brazilian free-tailed bats as well as 1,000 cave myotis. It also is going to impact several acres of golden cheek warbler and black cat burial habitat and fragment some of the last remaining large blocks of habitat in the Hill Country, and basically to the magnitude that probably hasn't been seen since the construction of I-10. We are the only agency conducting environmental reviews on this, and the Public Utility Commission does not have any environmental review staff on board. These lines are going to present basically an unprecedented impact to fish and wildlife resources potentially across the state, and it's going to fragment the Hill Country down to a pretty large extent. We're working closely in our program and through the agency to try and make sure that the environmental costs of these transmission lines, you know, don't outweigh the benefits of the renewable energy. And so that concludes my presentation, and if you have any further questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Any other comments for Kathy?
Yes,
this is a mess.
Yeah. Fun thing to talk about, and we're going to be talking about it for a long, long time. It's going to be ongoing. Yeah.
Well.
Commissioners, I think we just wanted you all to understand the significance of this to the agency. As you might expect, you know, there's a lot of impacts here, projected impacts. The issues about the siting, you know, oftentimes pitting landowner against landowner. You know, certainly our wildlife conservation model is dependent upon working collaboratively with private landowners. There's a lot of interest in this, and the department's role, Kathy and her team, I think, have really done an extraordinary job of trying to stay true to the science, which is certainly the direction that y'all have given us, and done everything they can to provide that input. And in her team, from a legal perspective, have been very involved. You should also know that Comptroller Combs has played a real leadership role here with her Endangered Species and Economic Development Task Force, and looking at, you know, the impacts of this and how you balance the competing uses. And so she's taken a real strong personal interest in this as well. But this is a major policy issue and resource issue for the agency, and we just wanted to make sure y'all had an understanding of kind of our role in that and what's involved and kind of what's at stake.
Just one, and another really isn't an answer, but your last point, you need to make sure the damage done does not outweigh the benefit of this renewable energy, but, you know, it must I ask, you know, who makes that decision?
Yeah.
How do you publicize that? How do you make, you know, people aware of that balancing act?
I think it's a great question, Commissioner, and I think it highlights some of the real tension between environmental and conservation groups that are involved. You know, so many of the environmental and conservation groups have really pushed very strongly for the development of renewable energy. And, you know, what we are trying to point out is that there are other costs associated with that in terms of fragmentation and habitat displacement and habitat disturbance and so forth, and potential impacts to species of concern that this agency is charged with protecting. And we have been a bit of a lonely voice in terms of raising those issues and trying to make sure that those are considered as well, you know, with the state's really strong economic development push for renewables. So we've just, I think, again, tried to stay true to the science, and I think that's been valued by many people in the process.
And I think, if I might add, we learned a lot during this intervention process. As Ann pointed out, we were effective in ways that we weren't certain that we were being, by in the fact that our mere presence at these hearings and during this proceeding actually had a big impact. Our comments and our letter and our direct testimony were brought up by almost everybody that was intervening in the process. Did you realize Parks and Wildlife made this recommendation? And also the fact that there were a lot of landowners there represented by their attorneys, and a lot of them came up and expressed their appreciation to us and the fact that we are involved in this process and we're representing the resources.
I think it's important to note, too, that also industry will reach out to Kathy and her team to get recommendations about what they can do to offset impacts. And so, you know, we've had a number of industry partners that have been very proactive about reaching out and asking what they can do proactively and preemptively. We strongly encourage that. That's a really important dialogue that we absolutely want and need to keep open and constructive so that they feel comfortable coming to the agency and that they can get good science-based recommendations on that as well. So I just want to make sure y'all understand that we consider that to be a core outreach effort as well. For industry that's involved in that as well. So,
thank you very much, Kathy.
Thank you, Gavin.
Thank you.
In light of our time, I'm going to rearrange our agenda slightly. Items 5, 6, 7, 8, and 11, which were scheduled to be heard prior to executive session, now will be heard following executive session. And in light of that, the following items will be heard in executive session. Committee item number 2, Val Verde County Land Project, Devil's River State Natural Area Property Exchange, Committee item number 9, New Park Search Briefing for Pelopinto County, and committee item number 10, Personnel Matters, Performance Evaluation of PPWD Executive Director. Therefore, I would like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of deliberation of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Texas Open Meetings Act, and seeking legal advice from the General Counsel under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act, and deliberation regarding personnel, Section 551.074 of the Open Meetings Act. We will now recess for executive session. Thank you.